Right, but again, it's what you're putting as the priority. I'll be honest, to me, the point of doing all that is to improve upon our understanding and our perspective on the bigger questions.
Yeah, I was saying before, that's really a Maimonidean position. But even without Maimonides, I think there is a question. I think you know, you're taking a very particular definition of orthodoxy. Orthodoxy ultimately is also an abstraction. What, you know, there used to be religious Jews and people who went off. There wasn't really any categorization. But there's a whole slew of people, especially in Israel. And I think this was much truer of the Orthodox membership of many synagogues, let's say 50 years ago, where the ideology, what made them Orthodox, is their belief system and not so much their practice. I'm not sure. I'm not sure that practice is ultimately more important in defining Orthodoxy than beliefs. I'm not sure why that should be. In other words, if you're looking at continuity, I look at people, a large portion of the Sephardic community in Israel is not going anywhere. I think a lot of the shifts that we've seen in the last 30 years in Israeli culture, it has to do with this group who, in spite of being told by the Ashkenazi leadership when they first came in that they were primitive, basically they held on to these primitive beliefs while actually giving up on a lot of the practice. And I'm not sure, I think on some level it's become a sort of accepted narrative that what keeps people within the fold is the Dalet, the four amot of halakha. Not so clear.
So I want to.
Higid lecha adam ki ma'alokim deresh mecha ki masot mishpat va'avat chesed va'hatznei alechet im elokecha.
So I want to. First of all, I wanted to. I think I want to answer Mark's question, which I think is a good question, and I want to make clear.
It's an answer to his question.
And I want to make clear where I'm obviously not. I haven't succeeded in making myself clear. So let's. So I think that the question of what ultimate purposes are and what defines a community are not the same thing. And I could, for example, say that it's absolutely right that the ultimate goal is some kind of deep appreciation of God or perfection of character. I'm okay with either knowledge or virtue as opposed to actions themselves. I'm perfectly fine with that. More than fine with that. I agree with that. I'm not a pure action person. I like virtue. But I can argue that the community, what sustains the community is the belief, or the collective sense, whatever you want to call it, belief is a bad word in this conversation, that practicing halakha will lead people to that end, and that we're humble about defining, starting from the ends, right? We start from these means, and we share the conviction that those means will lead us to that end, as opposed to starting by saying we know what the end is, and we're going to tell you exactly how you get from, right, how you get from here to there. I think that's the point I want to make. It's not that I, right? It's not. I don't want to claim the actions are the end. I want to claim that the modality of our community, right, is this system, and that we don't necessarily need to say exactly what the ends are because we accept this system as that. The second thing I want to say is that I think there is a difference between. There are people who don't believe that they're bound and still do it. Right? Social Orthodox. Right? So if you take them at their word, right? They don't believe right now. I might, as I said earlier, not take them at their word. But some of them I will. Right? I know. It was an ongoing issue of Maimonides, right? The parents. Parents who loved Orthodoxy because they grew up with it and who were very frustrated because their kids were not from. And I would ask them, do you think that your kids have to be from? And they would say, no, of course not. It's their choice. All right? But they were very frustrated because they found it beautiful. And they couldn't understand. And they were very frustrated their kids didn't find it beautiful, but they didn't find it binding. That's one thing. They thought it was beautiful and meaningful, but it wasn't binding. And then there are a whole group of other people who think that they are absolutely bound to keep halacha, but that they're absolutely bound to keep halacha doesn't make them do it. One of my favorite stories about this is on a plane to Israel some years ago. So I'm sitting there learning learning Gemara, and a Sephardi fellow sitting next to me says, "It's really good you're doing that." I'm very glad. I love seeing people learning Gemara. It's very important people have to learn Torah. And I said, "So what do you do?" He said, "I own a bowling alley." "Is the bowling alley closed on Shabbos?" "No." "Do you learn Torah?" "No." "So, but you think it's really important to me? You know, God wants you to learn Torah, all that." He said, "Because I have a deal with God. When God needs a soldier, he calls on me." And that's right, and God accepted this deal, so I don't do these other. But he doesn't, you know, he understands he's bound by it. The Torah makes, right? It's right, so all sorts of people who make, and all of us in some sense probably, you know, right, make some sort of deal where we say that God understands that I'm not doing this. So what I think is necessary to, what I'm arguing is that the beliefs that are necessary are those that enable you to think that halakha is binding on you and all Jews. It doesn't mean that only people who actually take those beliefs into practice are, I think that's what those communities are talking about, are the people who believed it was binding, for whatever reason they didn't do it, and they very likely they are more sustainable than communities that think it's really, really meaningful, but think it's a choice. Now, I think that the issue you raised there, which you're talking about, is whether, so that, something I try and, an argument I make to my students at some point about certain great scholars of the past century, and we could talk about specifics if necessary, who I think they're absolutely upstanding halachic Jews, and and I'm happy learning Torah from them, but they have beliefs that I think it's very, very unlikely that anybody who learned from them could accept those beliefs and think halacha is binding. They have found a way of squaring the circle. Well, let's take Professor Breuer, for example. It works for a certain narrow group of people. Most people look at it and say, "What?" And obviously, that's just a Rube Goldberg contraption to square faith in academia that doesn't work. So I tend to think that it's fair for a community to say, we don't want you to teach, at least we don't want you to teach those things in public, and if you go on teaching those things in public, we're not going to acknowledge you as a teacher of Torah in our community, because whatever we think of you, right, we think that we honor your struggle, but we think it's not a sustainable struggle for other people. The counter-argument is, maybe of the 20 people in this room, what they say resonates with one of you, and would be destructive, 19 of you could never take it. Maybe it's worth leaving that person there so the one of you can have that experience. And it's our job to counsel the other 19. I'm open to that possibility.
I just want to comment on the notion of functionality. I think in the sources you find a lot of the Rishonim actually in Chelek. And also the question that's raised in the Gemara about Zaken Mamre. Zaken Mamre, we're not talking about ideology there, but there you have a rabbi who's independently minded, and he simply does not want to accept. Again, he's bound to the truth. I think practice and truth, there's definitely overlap, and he's simply convinced of his halachic position against the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin says, "No, you can think that. You allowed your personal commitment to the truth, but you're not allowed to teach it." But his understanding of his commitment to the truth is not good enough to simply keep it to myself. After all, it's the truth. Truth should be shared, and therefore he insists on teaching it nonetheless. So he gets the death penalty. There's a discussion in the Gemara, and here's a great person. He's a sage. He's a tzaddik. The only problem is that he's stubborn about the truth. But so the question is raised in the Gemara whether you can forgive such a scholar, because after all, he's so well intending. And the Gemara says no, that this is going to create machloket. This is going to create division in Israel. In other words, ultimately saying there's a functional issue here, that I agree that a lot of the belief issues and the need for dogma in Judaism is viewed more sociologically than as a truth issue. All of that being said, and in spite of the flux that does necessarily exist, I think there are certain core beliefs that, you know, I think, for example, existence of God, you know, it seems like very broad, but I think, again, a person say, you know, that there is no God, I'm convinced of it, but I'm going to be completely committed to the mitzvot, it has excluded himself not just for functional reasons, that it's something that can't be sustained with the students into the next generation, but has excluded himself on an essential level, that he's simply not subscribing to something that could accurately be called Judaism, certainly not Orthodox Judaism.
So I have two things.
What's it as regards halacha, as opposed to a dogmatic issue?
So further, I want to. That's right. The two things. One is just Zagi Mamre never gets killed for teaching the truth. They only get killed for teaching that you have to act halachically.
Right. It's a practical
right.
Torah.
Well, entirely right. The truth itself is never a right. Is never barred in those ways. Only the halacha. The other is, so I also want to avoid the notion that that sustainability per se is the end. Right, that we get into the, you know, the Federation model where you continuity for the sake of continuity. I'm not interested in continuity as such. Community is entitled to think about some functionality as sustainability. It's not the end. What I did want to say. I'm losing it. Sorry. Let's try and get it back. I'm losing it, so I have to... Okay.
I have a question sort of related to this question of the sociological and this idea, or how you said about defining a community. So the issue is how we define a community. And, you know, whether it's through belief or practice, how it is. I guess my question is, and this may get back to the partnership minyanim, but if our concern is how we define a community and keeping that, is it permissible for one to experiment with practices that may or may not be accepted by the community 10 or 20 or 30 years from now? And is that any different in our age where we're more self-conscious about that and can make sociological statements about ourselves than in maybe past generations where there certainly was such change, but people weren't necessarily conscious of it happening?
Okay, I'm going to try and answer that in the context. Now I remember what I wanted to say. which is, I want to be clear, I think that you have to end up believing that you're committed to halacha because that is what God commands you to do. So I don't understand how somebody could say, I don't believe in God, but I think God commanded me to do this. That seems like a very hard...
No, but he's going to do it.
But I don't care about that. Right. It's not the beliefs that will lead you to do the halakha. It's beliefs that will cause you to believe that God commands you to do the halakha. Mm-hmm. Right? I want to be it's clear. That's why whether they actually do it is less important than whether they have... So that the question is, and right, this goes back to Alan's question, is... So, I think, the challenge is, at what point is experimentation within the legal system, and at what point is experimentation really a statement that I don't think the legal system is binding? That's a very hard line, right? That's a very hard line to draw, and it becomes very difficult sociologically because it could be that there are really big experiments that say, right, that are obviously don't in any way threaten the notion of the authority of the structure, and there are tiny little experiments that just reflect or they attract a community that fundamentally doesn't have that notion that the legal system is binding on them because God said so. That tends for me to be the framing. Not I think in principle that experimentation should be looked at at least with tolerance and sometimes with enthusiasm. I'm an American constitutionalist and I like federalism. So I think it'd be nice if we had laboratories of halakha. Mm-hmm. going, you know, going on, right? This is the community that will, you know, that will try tinkering with the edges around Zman Tefila. This is a community that will tinker around the edges about how to play, right? But you know, about how to handle Shabbat. You know what? Here's a community that's going to say, and there is one like now, it's really interesting to me, that's going to say, you know what? We're going to blow up all of Hilchot Kashrut because it turned out that it was just wrong physically. And steel pots don't absorb flavor. Mm-hmm. So we're just going to, right? So we're going to get rid of, right? So all the things, everything that you thought about glass is really true about metal, but not about glass. Right? We'll just start off, right? We'll start with, you know, I think that's it would be really cool if we could pull off a halacha. Right, halacha that a society where we could have 50 states and each of the states decided it was going to try something different.
We sort of had that when communities were separated by time and
communication. When you had these little hermetically sealed communities and I just saw on our schedule we have Dr. Sharon Shalom coming in the spring, right? Who is trying to construct a way of integrating the Ethiopian tradition in Halakha and coming up with a community that really has a very different halakha, right? Close enough to our halakha that's recognizable, but very, very different. You know, certain derabanans that came into being in the Talmudic era, maybe we don't need Ashkenazic ones that came about. We have biases. We're not so into probably, you know, allowing Utah to have polygamy. Right, we weren't into that in the United States, and we're not so into that with Tamanim now. of allowing polygamy to be one of the... But it's partially because we have the virtue, you know, that we don't tend to, thank God, to go to war that has large numbers of males killed out, so that we have an enormous male-female imbalance, for which polygamy is really the only solution that can meet human needs. So I think that, in principle, I am very much a fan of experimentation, particularly because I think that one thing that all serious halachas have to face is that halacha in the United States appeals to between 6 and 10% of the population. And so what we're doing isn't working as a broad framework. Now, you know, in the long run, it might work because the birth rate of the committed is much higher than the non-committed, and the intermarriage rate is lower, so it might be that if this rate will be a much smaller community, but we'll appeal to 90%. Demographics might end up doing that. But I think we're failing massively, and we have failed massively for 80 years with the American Jewish community, and so we could use all sorts of experiments. But the question is, part of the challenge we're facing is how many of those experiments really are capable of sustaining that notion that halacha is divinely commanded? And how many of them are not? And I think that's a very delicate thing. I have written this about partnership medium, which I've put in this, right, where it's not at all clear to me which way it comes, and it may very well have evolved. And it may very well be that, you know, like the Misnagdic story about Chassidut, that it's the opposition that ends up saving it. I think that's very possible in the end also, that we'll look in 30 years and it'll say, 30 years, look, here it is part of Orthodoxy, ha! They'll say, no, it's only because we kept yelling and screaming that otherwise you'd have gone off and God knows what you would have, you would all be Frankists, you know. I think that's very open.
I just want to comment that I think opposition is underrated. I think opposition, pushback, I was personally involved in pushback with YCT. I think it's critical. To keep people who should be kept within the community. I mean, movements do break off from one another, and the conservative Judaism didn't start as a separate movement. In fact, if you look at the beginnings of conservative Judaism and Hasidut, I would have put my money on conservative Judaism as being something that would have held closer to traditional Judaism, but it didn't work out that way. And I think a lot of it did have to do with not only the pushback, but the I think there's this, you know, pushback's only going to work if the people are really concerned about remaining within the community. I think that's you know, the Yirat Shamayim that existed in the Hasidic community was upset. You know, it bothered them that they weren't being accepted. And if it doesn't bother you, that's a problem. So I think that's important. I'll leave it at that. I'll leave it at that. Other questions or comments out there?
I should ask Jonas.
No.
All right.
We can continue.
Yeah. Let me go back to a point you raised at the very beginning about choosing belief. I think we're certainly limited. I think one of the biggest frustrations that people have with the whole notion of heresy or doctrine or dogma, whatever you want to call it, is that what can I do about it? As you said, how do I believe something I don't believe? So I'm not sure. Again, I think a lot of it has to do with taking our autonomy a little too seriously, again, accepting a sort of enlightened model of the person as an objective mind that simply follows, it's a few generations after the Rambam, but it's ultimately developed from a similar model, that all a person has to do is follow their mind, and without mistakes they're going to come to an unavoidable conclusion. I'm not sure that that's where most people are at, and again, the beliefs that people have, the more a person is self-aware, the more they realize that beliefs are not so clear-cut and so out of control. I think there are all sorts of things, and simply, who are you with? What are you doing? What are you studying? All of these things do shape a person's belief. And again, I go back to Rav Lichtenstein, and I think a lot of the problems that we have in our schools, and perhaps unavoidably, I'm speaking about modern Orthodox schools, is that essentially our children have bought into Western perspective of what life is about, what truth is about, what values are important. And what one rabbi recently wrote about the great challenge of the LGBT community, and our kids are completely baffled as how to square orthodoxy with that, with the assumption that whatever the values that are coming out of contemporary society are simply, it's not something you can argue with. It's definitely the truth. Whereas, again, I think there's a lack of sophistication, which is almost inevitable, given, most people are not sophisticated. It's simply the reality. Within that, I think self-awareness of, I'm not Kant, and what I think I believe is, you're willing to tell the student you don't really believe what you think you believe. I think it's very true, and I think perhaps one's true beliefs can't be changed, but one's feigned beliefs can be. And ultimately, as you said, post Kant, there's not much we can believe with certainty. The question is, where do you put your allegiances? Where do you make your leap of faith? And ultimately, I think in our context, there's a leap that's required, but it's no less irrational than all sorts of other things that we do. People think that it's not intellectually honest to try to push oneself towards one's belief. I came up with a really interesting introduction to a book. Some of you might remember it. This goes back maybe 15 years. Something called Guns, Germs, and Steel. I don't know if people remember that. Jared Diamond.
Yes, Jared Diamond.
Anthropologist at UCLA. Fascinating. I mean, what he went out to try to explain why certain civilizations are backwards, and why did Europe and the European culture advance so much quicker than African culture, for one. The name of the book essentially encapsulates the theory that it had to do with the fact that they discovered guns first, and they brought germs to the third world and decimated the population with both the guns and the germs, and steel also being some sort of commodity. And he explains it through climate, in which animals did well and which plants did well, and giving a certain advantage to certain groups over others. But the introduction is fascinating. He says as follows, you know, what I'm trying to do here is to not give a racist theory to explain this. Now, presumably, I mean, I would agree that going adopting a racist theory would be problematic and not a good way to go. Be that as it may, it's hard to call that a completely intellectually honest approach. I don't think we are. I think society pretends to be intellectually honest. All of us come with biases. That's what human beings are about, with certain allegiances and biases. Ultimately, when one decides what one thinks one believes, I think it's really important to identify and to not identify one's biases as something to avoid, but just the contrary, to accept one's biases as part of connection with a group and a way of looking at the truth. I mean, Ruth Cook, for one, God, who else says, I read someone else recently who also takes such an approach. But Ruth Cook says, you know, that the absolute truth is beyond the comprehension of human beings to understand what God knows. That, you know, as some have said, to, you know, if I understood God, I would be God. You know, it's simply beyond our reach. But Ruth Cook posits that every culture is really understanding God and reality through its own cultural prism. I think that makes perfect sense. That again, the objective universal man of the Enlightenment is ultimately a fiction. There is no such being.
So I'll respond to that, and probably you should get the last word.
Why?
So the first part I agree entirely. I used to. I like framing this around what is understood to be the Ramban's defense of the Baha'i's understanding of the first mitzvah. I'm not sure it's correct. That is what the Ramban says, but it's understood. The Baha'i leaves out the claim that Anochi Hashem Elokecha. Maimonides says that's the mitzvah, you have to believe in God, and the Baha'i leaves that out. And an understanding of Nachmanides' defense of that is that that he points out the circularity. How can God command you to believe in Him if you don't already believe in Him? Why should you obey? Right. Right, there has to be a commander, and so therefore, there can't be a mitzvah. To believe in God, because there can't be a mitzvah until there's a mitzvah. Right. So it's a nice circularity. And so I gave a drasha once, which I suggested that it's true in a certain sense, but it is also the case that people should be much more aware that your beliefs are largely determined by your social circle and what's plausible in your social circle. And if you hang around with people who ready to believe in God, then it becomes much easier to believe in God. And if you hang around with people, unless you know, you should know, like, you're the kind of deeply oppositional figure, right? So the best way to believe in God is to hang around with dogmatic atheists because you rebel against them. And they're always, you know, they're high school students, and you suggest that you should go to YU. And high school students would say, never go within a million miles of YU, because you're not going to want to, you know, you're not going to want to conform. You're going to rebel. Go somewhere where you're the only Jew, right, the only observant Jew on campus, and you'll thrive, right, because you're going to be out, right? So people have to know themselves and understand that the way, right, that where you put yourself is an important thing, and people should recognize it. And to that extent, you know, and if religion is a scary way to think about that, think about politics. And, you know, and figure out, you know, it's much easier to vote Republican in certain circles and Democratic in other circles, let alone admit it. But what I do think that, you know, should come out of what you're saying is, so society, like, we think of the question of whether there is an obligation for belief or not revolves around, you know, a catechism. Right? And the Maimonides' 13 principles function as a catechism, and so there are the people who think that we should train everybody to say after davening every day, "Ani ma'amin de'emunah shelema," such and such. Right, and the people, right, as opposed to there are people who think that no, right, you can't be right. They take Professor Kellner's thing really, and then the in between people are the people who say, "Well, maybe not those 13, but we can still come with a list of 3 to 5 to 7." And what I think you're saying is that the notion, the definition of belief that you want, is not catechismal. Right? You're not interested in propositional belief in quite the same, right, in quite the same way, and that's a huge shift. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of room to discuss the extent to which, for which sorts of people, propositional belief is a really important religious end nowadays. For Maimonides, it's all there was, right? So it's pretty astounding that we, you know, that we use Maimonides' 13 principles, even though we tend to function with a definition of religion that is very, very distant from that. So I would just put that out there, that, you know, that the argument you're making for belief, which I agree with, but we're using the word belief in a very non-Maimonidian sense when we don't make it cognitive, and the effective results of it are very different than you would have in a system which has you say the Gimli, which doesn't mean I don't think people shouldn't say the Gimli Karim every day after davening. If you're going, go ahead. I think that's also, you know, if you can read our fellow member, David Jaffe, has a book that you probably have all heard about now. If you haven't, you should all hear about it. I forget the exact name, but you can look it up on Amazon. And part of it is, you know, the thing that I get very skeptical of, but it's that, you know, saying certain things, right, makes you focus on them, makes you think about them more, right, makes it more likely. So it's very likely that if you say, you know what I need to do to be the kind of religious person I want to be is to really, really believe in the coming of the Messiah, that if you say, after davening every day, you know, I believe in the, with perfect belief in the coming of the Messiah, even though he tarries, I shall wait for him every day, for he will come. And you focus on saying that after 60 days, you'd feel ridiculous if you didn't really believe it. And so you'll believe it. So I think we should be aware of, you know, be aware of that, even if that's not the overall goal, but that there are circumstances in which propositional belief is valuable.
So if I get the last word, I'll just play off of that in terms of Maimonides' 13 principles. That part of the problem with Maimonides is that on one level he's been completely accepted, and on another level he's been completely rejected, such that his philosophical worldview, where these propositions come from, is very Greek in orientation. I heard that Moshe Del, who's not religious, who's a big expert in Kabbalah, got up
in
form. Sorry?
He davened in Talmud.
Does he?
Did?
Well, whatever. He's
he came
not,
to America, he davened in
Talmud. He's not traditionally Shomer Mitzvot, put it that way. And certainly not, whatever. Anyway. He got up and said, "Why should we listen to that Greek?" Referring to the Rambam. So most of us in our community have more deference towards the Rambam, but I think a lot of the issues come out of this problematic that's set up by the place of the Rambam in Jewish thought. That on the one hand, he sets the benchmark. On the other hand, no one. But the big Rishonim of his time, be it the Rashbe, be it the Ramban, almost no one really bought into his system, his intellectual system. So that we're, in the case of the 13 principles, so this sort of a gray area that's partly halakha or practical and partly philosophy. I think a lot of the issues, not the current issues, but certainly in Kellner and Shapiro, were centered around, well, what do we do with these statements that really don't fit into what Judaism as we practice, we believe, is all about. I mean, in recent years, and I'll open this up for your own thought and further interest. And growing up, and the Rambam was our hero. Because here's the rationalist. I mean, and he's brilliant in terms of his exposition of all sorts of issues, be they philosophical, be they religious. There's no one like the Rambam in terms of his breadth and brilliance. And so he was the hero because he was presenting this really rational view that if you're a rational member of Western society, you could buy into it pretty easily. The more I've learned, the more I see that the Rambam's ideology is really very imported and very difficult to fit in with traditional Judaism, with Chazal. I'll just close with this observation, for what it's worth, and it's something I'm thinking about. The Rambam, if you notice in his introduction to the Mishnah Torah, presents the Rabbi Yehuda Nasi as his big hero. He loves Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the author of the Mishnah. Now, what Reuven Nasi did was he took a corpus of knowledge and organized it in accordance with the culture of his time, which is very Hellenistic. But what he did not do was he did not really change the content in accordance with the form. I think the Rambam attempted not only to change the form of Jewish thought, but also the content. In sort of imitation of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, but not fully understanding what Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi pulled off successfully. Anyway, it's a kav machshava, so it's just something that's going through my mind. In any case, I think the Rambam Maimonides presents a very complicated legacy, which deserves more thought. You know, certainly not to take away anything from his greatness, but a lot of the problems that we have in understanding where Judaism stands as a religion center about, you know, properly understanding the Rambam and his place in Jewish tradition. So I want to thank everybody for showing up. You know, it's late.
Thank you.
You know, we're not going away, so if anybody wants to, I shouldn't speak for you. I'm not going away, but I guess I have to go when you go. Anyway, we're here for a couple of minutes.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Ari Sinet.
No, he's not.
He's in Los Angeles?
Yeah.